Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott. Hi, everybody. I'm Kelly Evans, and here's what's ahead this hour. Janet Yellen spooks the market, saying interest rates may need to rise modestly at some point. Her comments coming as the Nasdaq gets whacked for a third day with everything from the semis to cloud stocks to social names lower. We'll have a whole lot more on that. Pfizer reportedly seeking approval for use of its COVID vaccine in children ages 12 to 15. This as the company announces a big earnings beat and raises guidance. We'll speak to the CEO exclusively ahead. And inflation hits the cereal aisle. Robots suffer the chip shortage. And has Clubhouse already lost its cool? It's all ahead. But first, Dom Chu here with the market.
Twitter Spaces. I wonder how many people are going to be joining that Twitter Spaces phenomenon right now. But Spaces in the market right now are pretty much in the red. You can see there the Dow Industrials off by 0.5%, 33,951 the last trade there. The S&P 500 off about 1.3%. But as you mentioned, Kelly, the tech wreck is hitting the Nasdaq composite harder than other parts of the market. Now off 2.75% here, 13,521 the last trade there. I will point out that 13,511 is an important area to watch. That's the 50-day average price on a rolling basis for the Nasdaq composite. That could be an area of support or a battleground to see whether or not the bears can take it below there. We'll watch that level of the Nasdaq composite. Speaking of levels, 1.59% is the 50-day average yield for the 10-year Treasury note, 1.59%. You can see we're hovering right around there right now. It's important because we have seen interest rates on the downside as people flock a little bit more towards the safety of government bonds. They bid up the price of those Treasuries and the yield comes down. That's what we're seeing so far today. And it wasn't that long ago where we were talking about those technology stocks getting hit hard because of growth aspects being called into question if interest rates went higher. Well, today we're seeing those tech stocks go lower despite the fact that interest rates are also heading lower as well. That's an interesting change of pace than what we've seen over the last 6 months or so. Apple off nearly 4.5%, Microsoft 2.25% there, Amazon off by 3% and 3.5 losses for Alphabet, the parent company of Google. The reason why I say this is these four companies, Kelly, make up roughly 1/5, 20% of the overall S&P 500. They're a driving force behind a lot of that weakness so far today. We'll see if that trend continues in the afternoon. Back over to you.
That was a perfect little circle there as well, Tom. Thank you very much. As he mentioned, the Nasdaq is sinking sharply today. It's down for the third day in a row, and the Dow at one point was having its worst day in 2 months. It's recovered somewhat, still down 134. All five mega-cap tech stocks are getting hammered, as you just heard. The bellwether semi-stocks, well, they're sinking too, and they've had a pretty bad week. It all comes as Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says rates may have to rise to make sure the economy doesn't overheat. That didn't help markets today, but the sell-off was underway even before her remarks hit the tape. Let's dig deeper into the sell-off now with Barry Bannister. He's the chief equity strategist for Stifel. And Nancy Pryle is co-CEO and senior portfolio manager of Essex Investment Management. Great to have you both here. Barry, can you explain this sort of selling stretch that we've suddenly slid into?
Well, there is some aspect of the fact that May-October is typically weaker than November to April. And there's a buy the rumor, sell the fact aspect to earnings. We know the earnings were great, and the market saw that. That's why it ran up November to April, 27%. But then again, buy the rumor, sell the fact. Yellen's comments didn't help, but the Fed's been skating very close to the edge of the ice. They need to assert at some point that they have independence. And Yellen was sort of lobbing the ball on a lateral to Powell by taking some of the heat by saying what's obvious, which is that eventually, if things really pick up, the Fed has to tighten.
It's interesting you think she's helping him out because, Nancy, no one knows more than Janet Yellen how loaded her comments will be. for the markets. And to comment about the need for rates to rise could, to some extent, hurt the messaging from Powell. It certainly doesn't help the attitude in markets. If the Fed claims its objective is for the recovery to keep going to reach its employment goals, well, then technically comments like hers could undermine that goal. So what do you think was going on here? Or are we all reading too much into this comment made to The Atlantic, which, again, if it were from any other person on the planet, I would say we're probably making too much of it. But Janet Yellen knows exactly what she's saying and to whom when she makes comments like these.
Well, I do think that you're right. She knows what she's saying. And I think she's just trying to give the market some time to digest what is an inevitable rise in rates as the economy continues to heat up. That doesn't mean, however, that that's a rise in rates that's imminent, nor does it mean that it's a rise in rates that's going to get to any level that could totally derail either the economic recovery or, frankly, the stock market. So we think that the market is overreacting to both what will be a slower economic growth rate in the second half, as well as potentially higher interest rates, by assuming that that means we might be looking at something like 1970s era inflation, potentially stagflation, and all of those great worries. We think that growth will be well above trend line, that the Fed will stay relatively easy, and that we're going to see some PE compression, but strong enough earnings growth that will overcome that.
Yeah, and I know you're looking at it, themes that should transcend that, like the reshoring of manufacturing, names like Gates Industrial and some water plays, personalized medicine, you know, all those things that should triumph no matter what's going on. But Barry, let me turn back again to this peculiar situation that's playing out with the Fed and interest rates. So the whole point of what the Fed is saying it learned from the last cycle is that every time it starts talking preemptively about raising rates or tightening, they undermine their goals because the financial markets tighten for them. I mean, you could argue they're achieving their goals, but just ahead of schedule. But do you know what I'm saying? So we have interest rates down today, whereas if they just spoke the most dovish language on the planet, then interest rates would rise. And then that's kind of also how you get this self-cooling mechanism acting as a brake on the economy. So there just seem to be these two dynamics playing out where neither, you know, the cause and the effect, I can't quite understand in terms of what they're really trying to achieve.
Well, Chairman Powell is up for reappointment next year in the first quarter. The Fed's independence has never been this much under siege or under threat since the last time we had a massive populist outbreak in the 1930s. Back then, the Treasury Secretary Morgenthau would manage the avalanche of gold into the United States and control base money, reserves. Then from 1942 to 51, initially to finance World War II, but later after the war, the Fed was forced to cap or shield large parts of the yield curve. I think the Fed realizes that, you know, they're going to have to backstop all this populism, and it's in their best interest to say, hey, we're going to wait until we have substantial further progress, but don't think for a minute that for all eternity we're going to be this easy. And we were over 30 times trailing 10-year operating earnings on average. That's not a cheap multiple. So there's a lot of interest rate repression froth in the market. And I think that's what some of that's being eroded right now.
So to make sure I'm following what you're saying then, Barry, you think they're going to tighten sooner than expected. And that's partly why you're bearish on the markets?
Well, I was saying that in the May-October period, we'd have a 5 to 10% correction. I didn't have any doubt about that for a variety of reasons. I wrote a note about that yesterday. It's in the financial press in terms of summaries. But the other thing is to consider is that I think around Jackson Hole, Powell has to signal the taper of the QE. It's become unproductive now. We want the banks, not the Fed, to generate reserves. So the QE has to go. So that's the initial step in tightening. Later, we'll talk about interest rates. That's not going to be for a while, a good while.
Right. Rates weren't priced in until late 2022, early 2023. And that's why I think hearing those remarks from Yellen herself caused markets to stand up to attention. Have to leave it there. Both of you, thank you so much for your time, Barry Bannister and Nancy Pryle. Want to move along. Before we do, though, if you're looking for some names to buy in this market, J.P. Morgan just published its top stock picks for May. The analysts there say Alphabet is out. And Amazon is in. For the full list, head on over to CNBC.com/pro. Now we want to talk some Pfizer. The shares are lower today in what Jim Cramer calls a puzzling move after the company beat on earnings and revenue and raised its full-year guidance, saying sales of its COVID-19 vaccine continue to be stronger than expected. Meanwhile, the FDA is reportedly close to authorizing the vaccine for use in children ages 12 to 15. Joining me now with more on the results and the vaccination and the fight against COVID is the CEO of Pfizer, Albert Bourla, along with our own Meg Terrell. Meg?
Well, Kelly, thanks so much. And Albert, thanks for being here. You know, you reported Q1 results this morning. And let's start right there with what Kelly mentioned about Jim's comments this morning about sort of the head-scratching reaction from your stock to the results, not just the COVID vaccine, which, of course, is blowing expectations out of the water. You forecast now $26 billion in sales this year. You're forecasting durable revenue from the vaccine like a flu-like market. You developed it in record time during a pandemic, and you grew the rest of the business 8% during the first quarter. And yet your stock is flat today and only up about 8% year to date. What do you think is not resonating with Wall Street right now in terms of your business when you look in the face of everything that you have just done?
Meg, when it comes to stock, I think that this is not a sprint. It's a marathon. And actually, this is not my own quote. This is the advice that Ian Reid gave me when I took over. And what I know it is that you need to have to do the right things. You need to have operational performance. And the stock price will follow. So right now, I'm really focusing on creating more vaccines, producing more vaccines for the world, distributing them safely, making sure that we will be ready for the next pandemic, making sure that we will be ready for the variants that may escape the protection of our vaccine, and of course, investing in R&D.
Well, let's talk about vaccinating the world. You know, Pfizer has said you've got manufacturing capacity for up to 2.5 billion doses in 2021. You've struck agreements for 1.6 billion doses. Help us think about how to think about that capacity that's not accounted for right now, 900 million doses. If countries don't strike deals for those doses, what do you think is the right thing to do in order to supply the world? Should rich countries buy them and donate them? Is there an agreement that could be worked out with COVAX, the World Health Organization facility? How do you think about the best way to supply your vaccine to the world this year?
Well, those doses, which are at least 2.5 billion this year and will be 3 billion next year, are for the whole world. And price should not be an obstacle, because we are giving these doses at tier pricing. The rich countries, the high-income countries like the US, Europe, Japan, Canada, Australia, they are paying one tier. The middle-income countries, they are paying half of this price. And the low-income countries, they are offered these doses at cost. So right now, the price is not going to be the obstacle. We need to make sure that we have enough production for all. And this is why we keep investing, and this is why I feel very comfortable that we have these numbers. For several reasons. One, it is that we are having distribution manufacturing networks across the world. So for every stage of our manufacturing process, I have at least two or three manufacturing sites that are doing it. So even if something goes wrong in one, the others could step in. The second is that right now our yields, our processes are so effective that we keep increasing the production. And the third is that our quality controls are so good that we haven't rejected any single batch so far. Or let's say, I think 1 million doses out of 425 million doses that we produced were able to release. So it's I'm very confident that we will have enough doses. It's just coming in the next few months.
Mr. Bourla, it's Kelly here, and thanks for joining us. What does the experiences in India and Brazil tell you about the efficacy of the vaccines and our bodies in general, the antibodies in fighting COVID? You know, there's a lot of speculation right now that these resistance levels should be much higher among the population than they are. Does that mean it's because of the variants that we're susceptible to maybe getting it again, or that if people had resistance from being exposed or even from the vaccine, they still could get it again? How frequently do you think we're going to need booster shots or annual? I mean, is annual even frequently enough at this point? What's your latest thinking about this?
First, let's say that we should be looking at the data. And with all the data I have collected so far, there is no variant that we have identified that escapes the protection of our vaccine. Even the South African that has been, being the one that it is the most challenging one, our studies in South Africa demonstrated 100% efficacy. And we know that it was not easy for all vaccines to demonstrate efficacy there. But nevertheless, we are working on new variants, and because the possibility that one of them will eventually evade the protection of our vaccine is there. So we are developing right now, we have developed a variant for the South African mutant, but it is in the clinic, and we are going to see if we need a specific vaccine or not. But that will also used as a regulatory pathway. What we want to do it is to make sure that if a single variant is identified that it is escaping the protection of our vaccine, we will be ready within 100 days from that day to be able to have quantities manufactured and the files submitted to regulatory authorities.
Albert, it's Meg again. You know, India and South Africa have requested that the intellectual property around the vaccines be waived so that they can manufacture the vaccines themselves. What is your response to this and whether it could increase the availability of the vaccine in those countries and around the world?
Yeah, thank you. I don't think that the waiving of the intellectual property rights will do anything to their ability to manufacture. Clearly, for the mRNA vaccine, that I can speak, but it is our vaccine. Right now, the bottleneck is not manufacturing infrastructure because we have built enough, starting from scratch. Bottlenecks are raw materials. As raw materials are coming into manufacturing plants, we are increasing the production. And those raw materials, we have provided enough support right now, scientific, technical, and other type of support to our providers of the raw materials, which are highly specialized ingredients, so that we feel very, very comfortable that we will do 2.5 billions by the end of the year, as I said, 3 billions in total next year with the current situation. So it's not manufacturing capacity. And by the way, I don't think that any country right now is in a position to produce, or any company, mRNA right now over there, because there's no infrastructure ready. It's not that we were producing vaccines before and now we discover another one. We were not producing mRNA vaccines before. So I truly believe that it makes zero sense, not to mention about the disincentives that will create to the whole biotech industry, if waiting the patents, what does it mean in the next pandemic?
And Mr. Brule, it's Kelly again. Let me just circle back for 1 second on this issue. So let's say I was fully vaccinated 2 weeks ago. How long, in terms of months, should I expect that protection to last? Would that take me through all of next winter?
Right now, we do have clearly data about 6 months, and we know that 6 months post the second dose, we are having very strong protection. I have made comments publicly that we do expect that a booster likely will be needed somewhere between 6 and 12 months. And this is based on all the evidence that we have seen collectively, but remains to be proven. And those evidence are based on people that they have COVID-19 vaccine. After 6 months, that they had the disease. The number of people that get reinfection is getting higher. The fact that when we see our own protection data, although they maintain very high, above 90%, is 91 at 6 months. It used to be 95. But the fact that we see immunogenicity data that are showing that over the 6 months, there is a trend for declining. And also the fact that to protect about against variants, you need very high immune responses because those variants have the tendency to create lower neutralizing titers. So with all of that in mind, it's more likely than not that a booster will be needed between 6 and 12 months. And then we need to see, likely, it will be regular vaccinations to maintain the protection. But we don't know yet for sure.
And Albert, you mentioned that you have that six-month follow-up data, and one of the things that allowed you to do is to prepare for filing for full approval of the vaccine, which we understand you said this morning you will probably do by the end of this month here in the United States. What kind of timeline do you expect it might take, you know, for the FDA to weigh that and for there to be full approval granted? And how will that change how we use the vaccine here in the U.S.? Do you expect it could lead to more employers mandating it or schools mandating it, especially, of course, as you're awaiting imminent news for 12 to 15 year olds for emergency use authorization?
Yeah, thank you, Meg. It wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment how fast FDA will do it. FDA will do it in the speed that they feel comfortable so that they can review the file, and this is the right thing to do. Now, what could change if we have a full authorization? Under the emergency use authorization, you can commercialize the vaccine on the only under specific guidance from the government. So we cannot just give it to employers or to CVS privately or to other, to Walgreens, other vaccination chains, or the physicians cannot purchase it and use it in their practices. If you get full authorization, those channels are going to open. That being said, right now the government is still very, very engaged in getting contracts with us. So I think still in the foreseeable future, a very big part of this business will be driven by government purchases.
All right, Albert Bourla, that makes sense. And I should note, my question might have been misleading, as you're only planning to file for full approval in age 16 and up at the end of this month. Thanks again, Albert. We appreciate you being with us.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks to you, Meg, for bringing that to us. Our Meg Terrell for doggedly reporting on this issue. Coming up, it's been a tough week for chip stocks, which are selling off again today. But my next guest says don't throw in the towel just yet. He tells us why not and how long to hang on to these names. Plus, one of Wall Street's most prolific dealmakers talks to us about buying Yahoo, AOL, Michaels, and more. Who's next? Apollo's co-head of private equity joins us live ahead. And as we head to break, take a quick look at the S&P 500. IPG Photonics and Enphase are the biggest laggards right now, but more than half is in the red. We're back in a moment.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back. It's been a rough week in the chip sector with nearly every name in the space lower. The semi ETF, the SMH, is down 7%, and it's nearly 10% off its 52-week high. AMD, Broadcom, NVIDIA, these are all off by anywhere from 5 to 7 to 8 to 9%. But my next guest says, don't chuck these names just yet. Joining me now is Christopher Danely. He's the managing director and semiconductor analyst over at Citi. Christopher, it's great to have you. And just last hour during the halftime report, we heard a lot of bearish commentary about the chips in particular, the whole market watching them to make sure it's not a bellwether for, you know, stocks across the board. What makes you relatively more constructive here?
Sure. So the reason people are freaking out is that now you've had three semi companies come out and basically say that they're going to have a below seasonal quarter. This follows the heels of three above seasonal quarters. So, you know, understandably, folks are panicking a little bit. The reason we're not concerned is I talked to two of these companies. They said that their order rates are not declining. They're not seeing pushouts. They're just concerned that business has been a little bit too strong for too long. And so they're just trying to hedge their bets. And we don't see any of those, I guess you would call it classic signs of impending doom. I mean, first of all, there's still shortages out there. So I don't see how business can fall off if there's still shortages. So we're still telling investors to have faith in the stocks and stay offensive with semis.
So what would those classic signs of impending doom be that make it, this experience right now not quite rising to that level?
Sure. So we published this, we call it a top 15 rules of semiconductor investing. And number 7 talks about these classic signs of impending doom. Number 1 is when the shortages go away, that's when your spider sense starts tingling and you still see tons of headlines about shortages still existing. So for me, it's hard to believe that people would be about to cancel orders if they're still, you know, having problems getting product. The second phase would be the lead times. So lead time is just how long it takes to get a semiconductor. And as you have shortages, those lead times stretch out. You have to build inventory. First, the shortages stop, and then the lead times start to decline. And that's when you start hitting the panic button. But we're not even seeing the shortages end. So we're still pretty confident that there's going to be upside going forward.
That's fascinating. So you're reiterating your call to stick with stocks like Micron, NXP, Texas Instruments, and onsemi. How much more upside do you see? I mean, for people who are risk averse, would they just say, yeah, I take your point, but it's just not worth it? I mean, tell us what upside could be worth the risks of staying in for a little while longer to only then figure out when to bail?
Sure. So that's a question I get both on the upside and the downside. How much upside, how much downside? In 25 years of covering semis, I've learned never to call out a specific peak or specific trough or base it on price. This is a momentum space, and it's, you know, these upturns can last a lot longer than you think. Just as some background, so we're about the second quarter into this upturn, and they typically last 4 to 6. So I can't, I would hesitate to put a specific, sort of level as to how high the stocks can go, because they always go higher or lower than you think. However, we look for these specific catalysts like the shortages ending and the lead times declining. I'd say on average, we're about 20 to 25% upside for our price targets. However, if you look at not just mine, but all of my competitors' price targets, we're about 50% higher than our price targets were even 4 months ago.
Wow.
So, we don't think, so we don't think that there's any, any reason to get worried about the semis here.
All right. So people might, eject too early. Understandable. Chris, thanks so much for joining us to make your case. We appreciate it.
Happy to, anytime.
Christopher Danely of Citigroup. Coming up, forget the big Vegas names. If you're looking for casino plays to add to your reopening trade, you might want to consider this local stock, the name and what's driving its momentum ahead. Plus, Kroger and Albertsons both getting hit with a downgrade at Goldman, and both for the same reason. We'll tell you why and what's in store for the stocks coming up.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Let's get you a check on the markets right now. The Dow is well off its lows of the session today. The Nasdaq a little less so. Dow low is 347. We're only down 83. The Nasdaq low, we were down more than 400. We're still down about 335, 2.4%, much deeper sell-off in the Nasdaq than in the Dow today. But take a look also at some of the recent IPO stocks, which are all selling off. We include Lemonade, DoorDash, Asana, Palantir, and Unity Software in that list. And you can see the declines are between 3% and, in DoorDash's case, more than 5%. The social stocks and some of the dating apps, well, they're lower too. Snap, IAC, Interactive, Match Group down 5% or more. Twitter and Facebook relative outperformers in this group. If you look at Twitter, down only about 1% right now. Still in the red for the session, though. We'll keep an eye on the whole technology complex. Let's get to Rahel Solomon for a CNBC News update. Hi, Rahel.
Hi, Kelly. Here's what's happening at this hour. Use it or lose it. The Biden administration says that it will send more vaccines to states with high demand and lower allocations for states that are not maxing out their orders. Until now, vaccine doses have been divvied up according to population. And tonight on the news, Shep will speak to a vaccination expert about what's being done to keep up the pace of shots going into arms. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy is stepping up pressure on Liz Cheney, the third-ranking Republican in the House. He says that fellow GOP congressmen are losing confidence in her ability to do her job. This after Cheney traded insults with former President Donald Trump. French lawmakers have passed a sweeping bill to address climate change. It includes a ban on the construction of new airports and the expansion of current airports. The bill also seeks to reduce packaging waste. And Meghan Markle is now a children's book author. The Bench, as it is called, is a story inspired by the relationship between her husband Harry and their son Archie. The book will be on store shelves next month. And Kelly, she says that the book was inspired by a poem she wrote for Harry.
Aww.
It's so cute.
Yeah.
I'll send it back to you.
I'll have to keep an eye out for that. Rahel, yeah. Thanks. Still ahead, Apollo Global making another $1 billion deal with its acquisition of Verizon's media group, which includes AOL and Yahoo. Why are they betting on properties that can't seem to find a real home? We'll speak with the co-head of private equity in an exclusive interview next. Welcome back. As deal-making picks up, private equity firm Apollo Global is buying Verizon's media group. It's just the latest in a string of billion-dollar deals it's done since January, and it's helped the stock outperform this year, up 11%. What value do they see in the likes of Yahoo and AOL, and where are they looking for their next deals? Leslie Picker joins me now with the details and a very special guest. Leslie?
Hey, Kelly. Thanks so much. Now, Apollo has been one of the most prolific deal-makers of 2021. Six deals inked just in the first 4 months of the year, the latest being Verizon Media, which owns Yahoo and AOL. Now, the co-head of Apollo's PE group will join us in a moment, but I wanted to quickly share a few details from the quarter and the firm's latest multi-billion dollar deal. Apollo's distributable earnings jumped 78% during the quarter, thanks in part to some recent sales from the private equity portfolio. The PE group saw 22% appreciation during the first quarter as it works through its ninth fund, which it's currently putting capital to work in deals like Kraft's retailer Michaels and the operations renovations of the Venetian in Las Vegas. And the latest, yesterday's announcement that Apollo would be acquiring Yahoo and AOL, among some other media and technology assets, from Verizon for $5 billion. Now, many people have noted this, of course, is a sharp decline from the $9 billion Verizon paid for those two brands just a few years ago. There have been numerous case studies and postmortems written about the value destruction at both Yahoo and AOL since the internet bubble days. So now the question becomes, what's Apollo's vision for this acquisition that others fail to see? So let's ask the man in charge of it. Joining me now is David Samber of Apollo, co-head of the private equity group there. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, Leslie, thanks a lot for having me on.
You know, it looks like from conversations you've had about this deal that you are looking to move past such a strong reliance on advertising and focusing on other areas, particularly as it relates to the Yahoo Sports franchise and the Yahoo Finance franchise. Can you help explain that to us?
Yeah, sure. So, look, this is an iconic, a truly iconic set of assets. When you think about the Yahoo branded properties and even the AOL branded properties, it's a business with tremendous scale, 900 million monthly active users, one of the biggest internet properties in the world still today. But you're right, they currently advertise mainly through banner ads, which had very low monetization. So the opportunity, you know, as we see it, is to take some of these great properties like Yahoo Finance, Yahoo Sports, News, Mail, and even AOL, and continue to innovate, continue to invest, to grow revenue streams beyond just typical banner ads. And the one other thing I'll say, too, is they've already started to do this a little bit. The business really does have some strong momentum under the leadership of Guru, the CEO. And also Verizon, with their stewardship, they posted two quarters in a row of double-digit top-line growth. So the fundamentals are all there. But you're right. We do see a pivot opportunity that does have some execution risk, but we're pretty excited about it.
Okay, so let's talk about that execution risk, because I read that part of the plan has to do with, you know, maybe finding some way to monetize Yahoo Sports from a sports gambling standpoint. And then on the finance side, perhaps making some sort of financial product, even going as far as making a competitor to Robinhood, allowing for crypto trading or crypto content. Can you explain a little bit more about your thinking there? And then as you talk about execution risk, what are some of the big hurdles that you expect to face in kind of transforming those business models?
Yeah. So I think when you think about all these big properties with their big, loyal, sticky user bases, they have a lot of loyalty, they have a lot of users, and the opportunity is really entrepreneurialism. You know, for us, as an owner only focused on Yahoo, you know, we could afford to take the time and spend the money to invest in unlocking the value in some of these real iconic properties like Yahoo Finance, like you said. And whether it's potentially getting into financial technology products, brokerage, potentially even crypto trading, subscription products, you mentioned sports betting. You know, we really do have the ability to make those investments at our scale. I think for Verizon, not to put myself in their shoes, you know, they're a $240 billion public company. You know, to make those investments or go into some of these areas that have a lot of regulatory complexity, you can understand why they might not have wanted to go down that route. But I think for us, given our setup and given our orientation, we will be able to make some of those decisions. And I do think you'll see a lot of innovation, like you mentioned.
So in order to kind of pay for those investments, do you have to cut costs? A lot of people, when they hear private equity firm buying media business, they think immediately job cuts, other types of cuts. Is that something that you're planning as well?
Yeah, so no one's ever cut their way to prosperity. The good news is the vast, vast majority of this portfolio is very profitable and produces a lot of cash flow. So I think the real opportunity is allocating capital. We have a lot of experience making these capital allocation decisions. Another brand that we bought, Hostess, which I think is a pretty interesting case study where we took the Hostess brand and rejuvenated it and grew it a lot and introduced new products, I think is a pretty good case study. So I think capital allocation is going to be the name of the game here.
Great. Well, we will be watching closely. Thank you so much, David Samber of Apollo, co-head of their private equity group. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks a bunch.
Cal?
Leslie, thanks for bringing that to us, our Leslie Picker. Coming up, it's a new high for Ethereum. Inflation hits groceries and robots, and the Clubhouse download drop. It's all ahead in today's edition of Rapid Fire. We're back in a moment. Everybody, welcome back. Let's catch you up on a couple stories that should be on your radar right now. It is time for Rapid Fire, and joining me to help break down our headlines today are Julia Boorstin, Bob Bassani, and Courtney Reagan. Welcome, everybody. First topic, move over Bitcoin. Ethereum and Dogecoin are hitting record highs again today as blockchain and crypto continue gaining mainstream acceptance. Ethereum is now far outperforming Bitcoin for the year. It's up 344%. And today, the S&P launched the S&P Bitcoin Index, the S&P Ethereum Index, Bob, and the S&P Crypto Megacap Index. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I'll go out on the limb, and I will say that eventually I think Ethereum will be more valuable than Bitcoin. I say that because Bitcoin is essentially just a cryptocurrency. Ethereum, though, is smart contracts and far more versatile. And it's, they call it decentralized finance, but it's not really that. It's decentralized everything. Using Ethereum as a smart contract, you can use it to transfer ownership of real estate, for example. You could do it to transfer ownership of stocks and clear stocks. You can use it to send money overseas if you want to somebody else. It's just a lot more versatile, and I think people are starting to finally figure that out. That's why you're seeing that outperformance.
Bob Bassani with the big call that Ethereum, I mean, I'm going to be checking your Twitter feed, Bob, because it's not even provocative, right? I mean, these are the bull cases for ownership.
It's blockchain. Ethereum realizes the true potential of blockchain, which is a means of answering the question, how do I know I own anything? A big problem throughout the whole history of mankind. And Ethereum can be used for a lot of different ways to answer that question, a lot of different applications.
But still, Courtney, it has its flaws. I mean, I don't know enough about it, but I know that the critics say that it has anti-network effects, it has high transaction costs, that there are some security issues, that it's run by sort of, and this is the kind of, I guess you would call it the irony of a lot of these decentralized crypto plays, is that they're actually very centrally managed, just like our own Fed.
I know. Isn't that so interesting, Kelly? I'm kind of in the same boat with you. Just when I think I'm starting to understand it, then someone else throws out an argument that makes me question it all over again. But I do like Bob's point about Ethereum being a platform, sort of like the blockchain, of course, is attached to Bitcoin. So I feel better about Ethereum than maybe Ether. But of course, I know they sort of work hand in hand. Dogecoin, though, that one still just makes me feel silly. Like, it just seems irresponsible. It started with this dog meme. I spent a lot of time trying to understand it, and then I was more confused when I was done trying to figure it out. I don't know.
And it's at 58 cents today. So for everybody who remembers when it was a penny, that tells you just how extended this crypto move is getting. All right, moving along. Goldman is downgrading Kroger shares to sell today and Albertsons to neutral, citing slower consumer demand as local economies reopen. Plus, of course, rising costs from inflation. They've also lowered price targets on both stocks. They prefer Albertsons because of its smaller exposure to inflation risk and its cheaper stock price. Both names are lower today. Kroger's down about 4%, but posting gains so far this year. Bob, your comments?
Well, look, what's happening here is all the positive trends from last year are going to reverse now. So the work from home is not going to, I think, work as well here. The competitive landscape is going to get worse in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Aldi has opened up here. And, of course, we've got Amazon. So we're going back to the same old problems the supermarkets have had. Intense competition that's only getting worse. And now we've got the additional problems with the higher costs. We haven't even talked about the higher labor costs. You know, where do you get these are unionized shops here. So you're going to have a lot of problems in the near future.
Julia, what would you add?
I would say that we're up against some tough comparisons with the year ago period. Remember last March, April, May, people were really buying a ton of groceries and in a lot of occasions hoarding them at home. They were stockpiling last year in this quarter. And then you also have the fact that as people get out and about more, they're going to be eating more out. They're not going to be cooking and eating every single meal at home. And I think then you're going to see the grocery stores, you know, have to reckon with the fact that people might be buying lunch when they're out at their office, something which they never did a year ago.
Right. Exactly. Raise your hand if you own a Roomba here. Ah, two out of the three. Bob with the old school approach. All right. Courtney, I want to talk to you about this then, because the iRobot maker, Roomba maker iRobot, I should say, is sinking today. It's down more than 10%. This was after results. It beat first quarter estimates, but the guidance, it warned it has to carefully manage spending in order to deal with rising costs from raw materials and headwinds from the ongoing chip shortage. And we're seeing, Court, this chip shortage showing up everywhere these days.
Everywhere. I mean, this guy, we call ours the Wobot. And he's very smart, but you do sort of have to train him to move around furniture and this and that. It's also an expensive product. It's not one you're going to buy over and over. And maybe as you stay at home, work from home, work out from home, you look around and see dirt and dust a little bit more. So maybe that was sort of a pulled forward demand, but now people are getting out of the house again. Maybe poor Wobot gets backed into his corner and not used as much. Maybe we feel more comfortable letting a housekeeper's back into our house. So I could see some worries on the forefront going forward for iRobot.
Julia, you have a Wobot?
I do. I have my Roomba. We call him Fred. We turn him on when the house looks dirty, which is quite frequently. But here's the thing. We invested in a Roomba. We don't need to buy another one now. We also invested in a Peloton, and we pay a monthly fee to Peloton to access those classes. And I think that is the difference between these two types of companies that
saw a
benefit from the pandemic. Yeah. And I think that, you know, there are only so many Roombas you could buy.
Yeah, basically, iRobot needs to adopt a monthly subscription model, I think is what Julia is saying. Real quick, Bob.
Yeah, I don't have a Roomba named Fred. I have a broom named Gladys. But here's the thing. Forget about the component cost. This stock was up 200% last year. It was one of the biggest winners of the work from home trade. Now the momentum guys look at this. They look at the report. They say, there's nothing else here, really. And you can use component costs as an excuse. But please, it's been up 200%.
Yep.
And it's about time it's came back.
No, and
again,
we're starting to separate the permanently higher plateau stocks like big tech from the pandemic hangover stocks. And unfortunately, iRobot may be in the latter. What about Clubhouse, Julia? These numbers are fascinating. I mentioned this recently, but there was kind of this meme going around about how nobody actually uses Clubhouse. Well, now maybe the data are backing it up, because after hitting 9 million downloads just 2 months ago, less than a million people signed up in April, according to new figures. And we know that Twitter and Apple, of course, are making big pushes into the space. Julia, is it already over for Clubhouse? What do you think?
Well, what is so interesting about these numbers is that February was a month of spectacular growth for Clubhouse. Over 9 million people signed up. But then that growth slowed down dramatically. You just saw those numbers in the chart up there. But what's interesting is they say that the people who have downloaded Clubhouse and signed up for it, they're still engaging with the platform. So there's strong retention among people who are using it, but the growth has really just fallen off a cliff. The question to me is that decline in the growth rate due to the fact that people are leaving their houses again, they're going out to restaurants, doing all these things, maybe even going to movies that they didn't do before when they had more time to engage on Clubhouse? Mm-hmm. Or is it because you have Twitter Spaces and all of these other audio platforms where you can engage without having to open up a separate app on your phone? You know, Twitter has the advantage of the fact that you're already listening. You're already on Twitter and you just start listening instead of reading that feed. So I think those are the two things to watch, and we'll see whether those growth trends reverse again.
Courtney?
You know, I have never been on Clubhouse, and for a while I felt like, I'm missing out, but maybe I'm not anymore if we're looking at these trends. Julia is saying, of course, if you're already on it, you're still engaging, but maybe the growth is slowing. You know, if I'm going to take some time to listen to something, it's probably going to be a podcast. And because I'm not commuting right now, Kelly, and also I'm not running as much as I probably should be, I'm not really listening to podcasts either.
You know, it's funny you say that. I just got back in the car, obviously, a couple of weeks ago, and I'm back, you know, I mean, I'm, and it's so nice, Bob, to be able to listen to all this content again about how to discipline toddlers. Go ahead.
Well, that's a good way to look at it. So I'm not on Clubhouse either. I'm with Courtney because it interferes with my time playing Super Mario Brothers at night and other cutting edge games, because I'm a cutting edge gamer type. But here's what I would say about the podcast. 5 years ago, there were 500,000 podcasts in the United States. Not 500,000 people listening, 500,000 podcasts Today, there's over 2 million podcasts.
Yeah.
Everything that's popular gets absorbed in popular culture. It happened 23 years ago with the chat rooms. It's happened with the podcast industry. And it's going to happen with things like Clubhouse. We have Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. They're all doing competitions. So it's a natural kind of evolution to see it have a little trouble.
And I think it'll be tough for Clubhouse to sort of maintain its exclusive status. Guys, thank you all today. We've learned a lot. Julia Boorstin, Bob Pisani, and Courtney Reagan. Coming up, the big casino and sports betting names are sinking today, and that could be an opportunity to turn away from the Vegas Strip and get a little more local, the under-the-radar gaming plays that are on a tear in a moment. Welcome back. Casinos that depend on the gambling of Nevada locals don't usually grab the headlines, but they are blowing past analyst expectations, in part because the recovery has rapidly accelerated and a lot of people are moving in from California. In fact, March numbers for Las Vegas locals broke all-time gross gaming revenue records for the month. $256 million, you can see there. Best March ever. Boyd Gaming gets about a third of its revenue in Nevada and just bludgeoned consensus estimates with its first quarter results. The handful of analysts that cover Reno-based Monarch all have a buy rating. Same with Tiny Golden, which owns the Stratosphere on the Strip and a number of casinos around Nevada. And Red Rock, better known as Station Casinos, is almost completely reliant on the Clark County crowd. And that's for the better right now. Nevada's low taxes and sunshine are a big draw for the retirees. House prices are soaring. Construction is booming. And Decree points to these small cap companies, a great way to get exposure to casinos by paying a multiple of cash flow, actual cash flow, not just a multiple of revenue. Keep an eye on those names as we continue to watch the reopening baskets. And that does it for The Exchange today.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day. Same time, same place.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.